then I think I'm done. I don't have any further announcements, and we can start with the first talk. So let's go. All right, let me quickly bring up your slides. I'm a bit rusty. It has been a few years. All right, current status of post-quantum and so on. Please go ahead.
Okay, it's working. I'm Elsie, and I will give a brief update on the ongoing standardization process on post-quantum cryptography and the upcoming standards and protocols, which is partly done by IETF and other standard corpuses. And it's just a quick update on what to expect next year. If you're having some systems, if you're wanting to switch to post-quantum cryptography, if you have questions, drop me an email or write me via Matrix or meet me at Congress. Just talk to me. You can download these slides on my website. You can also just go to elfie.dev, and there's a link to the slides, and it's also in the pre-talks. And a short disclaimer, I'm not a uber hacker, academic cryptographer. I'm doing IT/OT security at my day job, and currently post-quantum cryptography is also a part of it, and so I thought I would give a quick update on this. So we have several upcoming standards by the ongoing NIST competition, which will be FIPS standards. It's one for key encapsulation, one and two for signing, which are FIPS 203, 204, and 205. The first one is the Crystal-Skyber algorithm, which will be used as the key exchange algorithm, and the other ones are for signatures or for signing stuff. And because NIST thought two signing algorithms are not enough, there will be another one released next year. It's called Falcon, the algorithm. And NIST announced last year another competition for additional signing algorithms, so you have plenty to choose. They differ slightly in signature sizes, key sizes, so it's more a decision of what would you like to use. The Crystal's Dilithium one is a pretty convenient one, which you can use for most applications. And the additional ones will be 40 candidates are under review right now in round one, and it will take, I don't know, maybe 5, 6 years, like the ongoing standards. IETF is also taking care of standardizing stuff for post-quantum readiness. So it's just a brief overview. If you go to my slides, you can just click the links and you will go to the IETF drafts. So we have stuff for TLS, we have SSH, we have IKA, we have PKI and certificates. And because we all like signature algorithms, there are another two ones which are already standardized by IETF, but they are rather complicated to use. So you can use them, but they are stateful hash-based signature algorithms, and they are a little bit complicated to use. So just don't use them, I think. Or if you have some corner cases where it is really needed. Otherwise, you just wait for the upcoming standards. And there's also some helpful RFC drafts and also the GitHub repository, which lists all ongoing IETF work. We have some real-world usage of post-quantum cryptography right now already. OpenSSH is post-quantum ready with a combiner hybrid algorithm. We have RosenPass, which is an add-on for WireGuard. We have Signal Messenger, Google Chrome, and there are also several libraries which you can use for implementing algorithms. And some software products and projects are waiting for the final standards, which are released next year by NIST or FIPS, but several ones are already implementing stuff and just for testing, but it's also production-grade ready. And in usual, it's combiner stuff, so it's not only the post-quantum algorithm, but it's combined with a classical algorithm, which is safe for now, and so you have both if the post-quantum one breaks. That's my last slide. General advice on post-quantum cryptography: stay up to date. There's really a lot things to come next year. Use post-quantum cryptography where possible and go hybrid where you can, and because for some data it might be a problem if it's captured now and decrypted once or in 100 years, nobody knows. Cryptography relevant post-quantum computers are there. Know your infrastructure and your endpoints and where cryptography, especially post-quantum prone asymmetric one, is used. And don't underestimate migration complexity. And the general advice, like don't run your own libraries in crypto, also apply for post-quantum cryptography. And yeah, that's it. If you have questions, just ask right away, not now. And yeah, thanks. Bye.
Thank you. On point, very nice, thanks. All right, next up is the Zorbis computer.
Hello, I'm Spolly, and I like to do lightning talks and retro computing. So I'm trying to excite other people for retro computing as well. But old hardware is getting harder; it's harder to get, and it also had some quiet obstacles. New hardware, on the other hand, is way too expensive just for tinkering. So I was thinking about how to build a computer for tinkering. So it should use an original 6502, since this was the CPU I've grown up with. It should be very easy in every thing way you can think of. So it should be open source, and it should be cheap, which makes it more a toy than a full-featured computer. And so I came up with the idea to use a microcontroller as the complete chipset to do the rest of all the thing of the computer, except for the CPU. So this, taking a look at the 6502 CPU that I'm using, counting the pins that I really require, I came up that 30 would be rather sufficient. I wanted to use the Raspberry Pi Pico microcontroller, however, the board only offers me 26 GPIOs. However, there's a solution to this. Just use a Chinese clone, which offers not only 30 GPIO pins, but also 60 megabytes of flash, which come in handy. And it also offers another nice feature. Within limitations, the GPIOs can be used with 5 volts. My architecture is really simple, just like a 70s computer. I just have a passive backplane where I put in a board with a CPU. I put in another board with a chipset, put it all together, and just call it a computer. So the first thing that I did with this one was to replicate an already known computer. I chose the Apple I because it's a very simple architecture, the simplest computer I know so far based on the 6502 architecture. The video generation circuit, which was half of the PCB, could be replaced just by using the USB terminal for a user interface. The second step was to build a machine or a core for learning, which allows you to watch the bus on every single cycle the CPU takes. So you can think of it like a pure poor man's logic analyzer using the CPU. And the third thing that I did was, of course, I wanted to build my real own computer with some features that maybe the old machines didn't have, something like a random number generator, which is really hard to do on an 8-bit machine, or something like a storage interface, or sorry, already storage included in the machine, which is also nice so that you can save and load stuff from it. Of course, a computer needs a name. It uses a Raspberry Pi Pico to run like an Apple. So, of course, this name has to be some kind of fruit. Originally, I wanted to go with lemon because if life gives you lemons, make a computer out of it. However, this term was already used by an Apple II clone. So I stuck with the term Vogelbeere in German, which is Sorbus, because my mama told me, don't eat those, they are poisonous, so don't use them for the primary purpose. But as a kid, I had a lot of fun playing with the berries. Where are we right now? So we've got two different machine language monitors to work with. We've got even an operating system, CPM, which was one of the first operating systems originally written for microcomputers, has been ported over from the Intel 8080 by some crazy Scotsman to the 6502. And the kernel that's already included has already quite some nice functionality inside, but still it's growing. For the future ideas, I wanted to port typical environments like BASIC or Forth to the machine, where also help is appreciated. And for hardware, since I'm also doing a lot of demo scene stuff, I want to make this into some kind of demo scene platform. So I need some graphics hardware, I need some soundboard. Graphics is already in the working. Some friends of mine are discussing how to do sound. So we're getting somewhere. And if you think this sounds nice, visit me after the lightning talks in the vintage computing area. I've got parts for 10 machines, so you can solder your own. You've seen the PCBs, it's easy to solder. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Next up is Reliable Radio Communications. Where's my mouse? My mouse is here. Okay. There we go.
Moin. I'll show you how to get more range and reliability out of common radio transceiver modules, or more generally out of any self-synchronized serial link. So many startup projects consist of a microcontroller, receiver, and a transmitter, and here we have no antennas. So the RF energy communicates over the ground plane, and we get no experience how the medium actually behaves. The better approach is to use a real antenna and separate power supplies, and now we're in for the ride. We have to expect a lot of problems because of the noisy nature, and if we look at the orange curve, the fastest baud rate, we see that we need an amateur radio language on S7 to S9 levels, so really loud level to get reliable performance without too many errors. And how bad is it? There's only for every bit we roll the dice, and only one happy pass with every bit correct gives us a correct packet, and that means we're for a payload of 64 bytes, we have to have the loudest level at S9 to get only 95% of the packets correctly. So how can we combat this? We can use a forward error correction, and where we multiply our incoming signal on the transmitting side, we multiply our bit stream with a matrix, expand it, and add redundancy so we'd have a chance to reconstruct the signal at the receiver. So the problem with this is that the matrix can still give us a runs of all zeros and ones, and that breaks the hardware reconstruction of the clock signal. But I've set out searching and found an old approach to shorten the longest run length. And we can simply do this by swapping the last two columns of every half in the matrix and add an alternating pattern. So this replaces the common approach of XORing with a pseudo-noise sequence. And this is the run length really gets shorter. And what's missing for a whole system is a frame synchronization marker that tells us where the packet starts on the receiver side. And for this, the extended Golay code doesn't use all of its code words, and I can just go around looking for the one that gives us the best correlation. And this is the code. It's a simple multiplication and error, frame synchronization detection. And this is the decoder from Burley Camp from NASA JPL. So we got this running on a 7021 on a Cortex M0, like the Raspberry's microcontroller. And we achieve about 2.5 megabit per second, which suffices for all modern they are ISM transceiver modules. So if you want to help me or I can help you, contact me on the hub or per email. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Inventory, OSS Inventory and PLM.
So most hardware people here know the problem. You have a lot of boxes with a lot of components. And every time you design something, you ask yourself, do I own it? How much do I own it? Is it even good anymore? So we need a solution, an inventory management, like Inventory, the project I am presenting today. We do parts management, we do parameters, so freeform parameters that you can assign, and we do stock tracking and a lot more. I'm Matthias, I'm from Austria, and I have been one of the core contributors since 2021. The Inventory project is MIT licensed. We started in 2017. We have 3 to 5 active people. They do most of the work, 75 contributors and 50 translators. We are always searching for translators. So it's very hard to translate and proofread a lot of languages. So if you can do that, we would appreciate that. Inventory.org. The main components of the system are simple. We have a server client architecture that where you host a central API service, and then you can use a web interface, you can a web front end, you can use an Android or iOS app, you can use Python APIs or anything that can speak open API specs, so most languages. We have some core business objects, parts. You can have a lot of one part, so that's stock then. You can have orders, you buy stuff, you sell stuff, you sell stuff to a customer, he returns it, that's a return order. And you have builds, where you build your parts from other parts. All these models can be extended without touching the code. You can have strongly typed parameters, where you can do SI conversation and stuff, so that you are always in the right format. And you have loosely typed JSON metadata, where you just dump your stuff. So we don't care what's in there. And you can have plugins without changing the core code. We are enterprise ready because a lot of enterprises run us, well, small companies, but enterprise. So SSO, all the stuff, you can deploy to Debian and Ubuntu with a built-in package. We have Docker images, install scripts, a DigitalOcean image, if you like that stuff. I don't, but I build it. We support most best practices in the community, so we have an open SSF best practice badge, and we should get silver badge in the next 1 or 2 months. We still have to do some dynamic testing to achieve that. 90% code coverage, enforced code styles, all the good stuff that you need to deploy us. And we are always open for feedback. If there's a standard we should support, please reach out. We have plugins for Shopify, Mouser, for different BCBA companies. We do loan management via a plugin. You can connect your label printers, Prada, Zebra, and everything that does cups, so most printers, but only on Linux. And we can do notifications with emails, Slack, and 50 others via AppRise. There is KiCad integration with the upcoming 8.0 release, or with Nightly, but you shouldn't run Nightly for your production stuff. Please don't. We had problems. And there are various CLI tools. We are starting to implement vendors into the core code, but it will take a year or two. So there are some great tools by the community to do that via the API right now. We need you. You don't need to code. You can report bugs. You can translate or proofread. You can write documentation. You can develop if you know some of the languages. You can fund. Or you can just communicate around the project. Inventory.org/contribute. Please come. We welcome everybody. So we have some friendly projects in the community, namely PartDB, very cool project, basically the same function set, but just one developer, and in PHP. So great shout out to Jan. And Kitspace, they do like open source hardware project repos online, where you can just buy your open source project. So it's much easier to start in the community. And they are doing some great stuff around standardization of sharing stuff. We are planning to integrate their standard in the next 1 to 3 months. I have the PR already ready, but I need to do some testing. So contact me or the project on inventory.org or mgmi.com, and the slides are on 37c3.mgmi.com. Please reach out. My deck number is in the 30s on the last page. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, next up is Sun Juice Collector for our makerspace.
Hello everyone. Maybe some of you heard about balcony solar power stations. And I just wanted to present you our project, how we implemented a solar power station in our makerspace. So in Freiburg, we like to put Frei in front of everything. So we have Frei Burger, we have Frei Spiel, and of course we have Frei Lab, which is the makerspace. And there we wanted to implement the solar station because we wanted to have our own green energy for our workshops. So because we didn't have an idea how this will look like in the future, I asked ChatGPT, how does that look like on the Frei Lab? It cannot even spell the name right. Okay, so first what you need, what we did is we took some old solar panels, which are from old public buildings, and then we reused them for our makerspace. So you can even put those panels on your balcony if you like. There are also some workshops in Freiburg and I think all over Germany how to do that. If you are interested in that, reach out after this lightning talk to me. So this is the concept. So we have all our solar panels. We have a current. We have the current inverter, which puts the DC current into AC current. We have our rooftop, and we have our workshop, which then gets the energy from the solar panels. So this is the rooftop. We wanted to implement it to the rooftop that's a little bit more on the right, but that's very old and there's asbestos in it. And so we thought, okay, maybe it's better to use the rooftop here. So what's always important, check if the old panels are working. So that's what we did with the multimeter. We measured, everything was working fine. Okay, so we continued. So some of the solar panels had some broken plastic at the back. So we have a laser cutter because we are a makerspace. So we fixed that and then continued on putting the solar panels on the rooftop. Maybe consider doing it a little bit more safely than we did it. But it worked out, looked pretty cool in the end. And this is the final result. So yeah, now we are collecting the sun juice, or like the energy from the sun. And we, of course, also collecting data on how much energy we are collecting. So this is a little bit older. I showed that on our Christmas party. But so we collected so far 230 kilowatts. And are still collecting this data and also wanted to show it to everyone who is part of our club later on, but this will be another project then. So this is how ChatGPT thinks it looks like when a cat is putting the solar panels on our makerspace. To summarize this. And in the end, I also wanted to give you two links. So if you are interested on putting old solar panels on your balcony and collecting energy for your own home, which is pretty neat and a super cool thing to do because otherwise these solar panels will get thrown away and not reused, then you can use the solar panels and maybe visit some workshops. Visit the website Balkon Solaranlage or look up Balkon Solaranlagenverein Freiburg, if you can remember that. And then there's also the Frei Lab. So if you are from Freiburg or from the land, as we also like to call our Bundesland, then you can also check freilab.de and maybe visit us on Wednesday because then we are open to the public and everyone can visit us. And we are happy to show you around. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Youth Hacking for Freedom.
Hi, I'm Bonnie from the Free Software Foundation Europe, and I have a slightly different topic today. I have a programming competition. First, a few of you might be still that age, and some of you might know others, for teenagers from 14 to 18. Yeah, I will quickly introduce you to Youth Hacking for Freedom. So, what's Youth Hacking for Freedom? It's the FSFE's programming competition. Kids can develop their own project, they come up with an idea, we always help. There are no limitations in the ideas. The only requirement, it needs to be free software in the end. We also help with this. We have some monthly calls, of course, and there we teach them about free software. And now to the question, who can participate? People between 14 and 18, they need to be from Europe, not just the EU, so UK is still included. And you don't need to have an European citizenship, you just need to live in Europe, so also refugees are welcome to join us. This is where you can register. Registration is currently open, and it will also be possible to do late registration, but then the programming period will not be extended. So if you want to register, go to this website. And now for the programming period, it will start on the 1st of January, so next week, and then you have 6 months until the 13th of June in 2024. During those times, we have monthly calls. In those monthly calls, we have an input session, for example, on how you can upload your project to Git, how you can work with Git, how you can license your project as free software. And yeah, of course, we also help with questions. We have a legal team in the background at the FSFE who is always there and happy to answer questions. And yeah, we also have some talks and input sessions about motivation and that projects are never really finished. And after this input session, you have the chance to network with the other participants in smaller breakout rooms, meet European teenagers from all over Europe, and yeah, just meet like-minded people, and there have been friendships built during this competition, so it's a nice thing for you to also meet other people. And now, yeah, that's already said, we provide help with legal and licensing question. We can't provide help with the programming, so but you're always encouraged to ask others for help and to ask your teachers, people you know, so it's you're never on your own. You can, like the spirit of free software, reach out to others and build a community. Now for the most important thing, of course, is have fun. For the prizes, the first winner will get around 4,000 euros, and the second prize will the second place will be 2,048, and third to sixth, the third is still in, like in the normal ranking, and then we have three special prizes, that will be 1,024 euros. Yes. So, and of course, follow us on social media. There you will stay updated on all the competition and everything. Yeah, that's basically it. You can register here. And I would also like to point out that we will be in the FSFE booth. So you can visit us there if you have any questions. That's at the Bissam Bäume Assembly. And I'm around. Just ask me anything you want. And yeah, it's a very nice competition for you to join and meet others. That's it.
Thank you. Next up is Tech Time Travel.
Yeah, hi, I'm Oliver. I'm a software engineer from Berlin, and I like to code in Clojure and Clojure Script. But today I want to tell you about a little journey involving old files. Because about 2 weeks ago, I saw this lecture series by Dr. Knuth, Tech for Beginners. And this was recorded in February 1981. And that was fascinating for me for several reasons. At the time, tech was still kind of brand new, but it was already used in some of the campuses around the country in the US, but also in some companies. And secondly, a lot of the students that participated in this were not actually CompSci students. They came from other fields. They also want to have beautiful papers and so on. And even some students from outside, from companies like Xerox and so on. And secondly, most of these students wouldn't have a computer, right? This was a time there were no laptops or anything. So fascinatingly, Fascinatingly, Knuth would go through these lines, explain all the macros, all the commands. People would take notes, go to the lab, try them out, bring the printouts back, and then discuss them. For that purpose, Knuth holds up this handout that he printed out. And he also did that in Tech, obviously, is this tool. And he explained, this handout explained how they do that. But the first order of business was going through this, explaining all the things wrong in this tech out, in this handout. Because the Dover they were very proud of, called the printer called Dover in room 221 was broken, and that was set up to do this tech these printouts. So he needed to tell them the new commands, how to do this, and all these kind of things. Right after that, he just went to the source of the handout itself, and then went line by line, what does this command do, what does this macro do, and so on. Later on the section on the right there, you see a bit more complicated things with mathy things. And around this time, I was like, well, it would be really useful to have this file, to actually follow it along and have that handout in my hand. So I did some very naive searches of what are the strings I saw in this text. Maybe someone had copied a PDF somewhere. And that didn't work at all. And I gave up quite quickly because it was a long shot anyway. Until day three, when he went through some error logs that students had printed, right? And you can see here on top, errors.tmp and so on. And this gave me a new hope because I crafted some other search strings. And lo and behold, there was a match here. And you can't probably see it on the slide. But on the top right, that is exactly one of those outputs. And it's from the 25th of February, 1981. It's one of those students that did that. And so what is the site, right? It was very excited. It's called SailDart. And Sail stands for Sanford AI Lab. And this is basically an archive for the last backups from the tapes in 1990 that someone took. And it's maintained by Dr. Bruce Günther Baumgart, and it's fascinating because it's a time capsule from files from 60s, 70s, 80s, and it has loads of stuff on research files, code, documentation, faculty data, and even memos and emails from that time. So long story short, I went through that, and there it is. That is exactly the hand.tech that he went through in that thing 43 years ago, which was exciting to me. I don't know whether you feel about that the same way, but I downloaded some auxiliary files, and tried to tech it with today's tech. Didn't quite work. I had to adjust a little few little things. But after a while, it actually does run with the current tech version. And as you can see here, now I have this exactly this handout that he held in his hand. I can print that out, and I could go through it with him together. And that was magical to me. That's why I share it. And the main message I have here in conclusion is that text files are awesome, right? This works because it's not binary. I couldn't have read this if it was some binary thing that I couldn't have searched through. You can also edit them with any editor, text editor, make adjustments, search them automatically, or have some other scripts run through them. Secondly, it's awesome, I think, to me that you can typeset this and print it 40 years later. Some of you may remember a time when the new Word version meant that all your other documents now look all wonky. Third one is, if you want to follow this lecture series, you can come to me. I have the handout. You can print it out. If Dover's not still back, maybe wait till Friday, because it should become back at some point. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next up is, pornography feels better without tech giants.
Okay. Hello, everybody. My name is Alessandro Polidoro. I am an independent lawyer and digital rights advocate. And today, I want to spend the next 5 minutes with you to talk about why pornography feels better without tech giants. So let's talk about porn. Porn is a multi-billion industry. I didn't specify the numbers here. The current estimation is around 45 billion, but some say a bit less, some say a bit more, even up to 90. And the reason why it's difficult to quantify is because there is a lot of submerged business that is not exactly happening in broad daylight. It represents a huge portion of the whole traffic of the World Wide Web. Some say it's 8%, some say 4%. Once again, it wasn't really meaningful to put any data because there is no clear source, but point here being, porn is a big deal. And it has also an ever-growing impact on our culture. We know it because in the past decades, this flooding of free pornography available everywhere on the web, of course, is impacting our culture. And for some people, especially the young generation, it has become one of the main sources of sex education. Of course, pornography is not an easy topic. It's not an easy topic to talk about, first of all, because there is a huge resistance from lawmakers, journalists sometimes, even funders, to be honest, because it's a difficult topic. And it is also politically controversial, setting aside for a second the ultra-conservative groups that, of course, would want to ban sexual representation because they believe that it's immoral. There is also an issue in the more progressive community, even among feminists. It's not clear if pornography is actually an instrument of repression or is actually a way to express each personal sexuality. But most importantly, and this is what I would like to stress in the remaining minutes, is a field that is dominated by tech giants. Right now there is a huge bottleneck of this sector with few players basically dominating the market and setting all the trends that are influencing the life of those who inhabit this field. And the porn narrative, so everything that revolves around porn, is very important, especially for four categories to what I've had the opportunity to observe. Digital rights advocates, and this is clear, it's not only about accountability of tech giants, but it's also a matter, for instance, of data protection law. Think of these dystopic solutions that have been presented, like asking people to show an ID when they access pornography so that the age can be verified. But it's also important for workers' rights defenders. There is a huge stigmatization of this field of work, and it's very dangerous and unsafe for the people that work in this field just to carry on with their life. There is, of course, a huge issue related to gender-based violence and the survivors, especially, for instance, of image-based sexual abuse and these other topics, and sex tech builders, because, of course, there is also the constructive part. Think of ethical porn platforms or small and medium enterprises that want to build sex toys and stuff like this. But there is one way to fight against tech giant in porn, and one of them is to sue them. And as a lawyer, of course, I wanted to bring this up first, because we actually sued Pornhub. You may have heard about this porn platform. They used to be the 12th most visited website on the planet. The lawsuit is ongoing, but they've already lost two positions. Now they are the 14th most visited website on the planet. Correlation is not causation, but it's interesting to say that since the lawsuit has been started, they actually already changed their website, kind of basically running for cover from our accusations. And there is also another way, and the other way is, of course, to hold them accountable. And in this specific case, I wanted to refer to this campaign that we launched, addressed to the European Commission, because the idea was to leverage the Digital Service Act, this new European regulation that you may have heard of, and to ask porn platforms to be mentioned among the very large online platforms which will now become exposed to major due diligence obligations. Of course, there is so much more that can be done. And this is all something that we're discussing in this new multi-stakeholder coalition that has started. So if you're interested to know more, feel free to reach me later or ask around on the internet. Also, there is a lot of material regarding that. And if you would like to know more, this is a small nerd quote for the sci-fi fans out there. I don't know who of you will get it. Well, if you want to know more, we're going to have a self-organized session later tonight. It's going to be, we're going to talk about porn late at night. It's at stage H, so ground floor. And feel free to join us. We will talk about a little bit more about the litigation and about the advocacy campaign that we have done. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Just a quick announcement, since we are well in time. The talks from about 20 past 5 are going to be in German. So if you need a translation, if you are in the hall and need a translation, or if you listen on the stream, check out c3lingo.org for a simultaneous translation to English. That's around 20 past 5. Then we are going to have German talks. So now I closed my file manager, which means that I have to bring it up again and close the slides instead. All right. Talks, day two. Next up is Vudika Events. Here we go. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Matthias. I'm from Austria, which is why I'm holding the talk in English so you all can understand me. I've started a free and open source project that does event aggregation last summer. In a nutshell, it basically is many crawlers that go around and take all the public events data, put it into a central database with an open API, and we have many publishers where you can get that data back again. Why do we do that? Mainly because it's really, really annoying to go to 100 different sources to get to find out what is happening. This is a problem that so many communities have, including our big community here. If we want to know what chaos events are happening this year, we have to go to many, many, many different pages to find that out. And that's one of the things we want to solve. There's also the problem that if you are a new organizer or if you're a small organizer, you kind of have to go to the big events.com, facebook.com, meetup.com to publish your event to have people find out that you're doing something. And we think that's really annoying as well. And the last but not least is accessibility is really important. Both the data of events, but also the events itself can be improved by adding accessibility features here. This is why one of the things we do is we enrich the data that we get. So when we get event data from locations that we know or from locations where we can get accessibility data as well, we also add, is this venue wheelchair accessible, and many, many other things. In a nutshell, that's what we do. We don't want to be the primary source for things, so we want publishers to have their own sources that they control where they have their events. We want to just crawl things. We want to be always the second or third in line, whatever it's necessary. We're currently very local for Austria, but this might change soon, hopefully. We have a project on GitHub. It's under GPL, and we would love if somebody wants to do this for the chaos community or for Germany or for something else. We also have a self-organized session tomorrow. You can find us at 8:30 in Halle E. You can also write us an email. You can find us on GitHub. And you can talk to me anytime during the Congress or after. You can find me as Yolgi pretty much everywhere. We have quite a lot of plans for the future. We want to connect multiple services together. We want to make more specialized publishers where, for example, for old people's homes, they get PDFs of exactly the events that are reachable on foot in their region. And stuff like that could be semi-automated or very automated, and that would be awesome for many people that have needs for better accessibility. We want to do more generic crawlers that can be easily configured instead of just written specifically for the sources, better enrichment, better search and filtering. So lots of big plans. If you're up to it, please join our self-organizing session or come talk to me. I'm both in English and German, of course. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is Air France KLM 6-character short codes.
Hi, I'm Benjamin from Netherlands, and on Friday the 15th, the Dutch Broadcasting Foundation, better known as NOS, got a tip about a KLM data leak. So KLM sends these text messages if your flights get cancelled, delayed, or with some nice URL with an ultra short code, so they can send more than 300 chars to text messages actually. But the problem is this link goes to a redirect page that does not have any security question asked, like a last name or a zip code or email address, and will just show you passenger info. In this case, actually, somebody entered the wrong phone number, so it ended up at the wrong person, so it wasn't a huge data leak. But Joost from the NOS questioned to me and another security researcher, like, isn't this 6-char code too damn short? Well, it turns out it was actually case sensitive, so if it's just alpha, it's 26 times 2 to the power of 6, which would make like 90 billion combinations. So let's verify with some random bash scraping that this is not feasible to scrape. This will fire off 26 parallel curl commands, and thanks to the nice URL globbing of curl, we'll just fire it off. Well, we got 94 not founds, 404s, some mixed up letters, and after a while, we got some four trees access denied. And we already got like two redirects to the backend to the pages. This is crazy, right? We just checked 100 codes. It already returns data. Actually, of course, these are dummy UUIDs because these UUIDs worked until a few days ago, and I'm not sure if they're fixed everywhere. So the Tom, at the same time, the other security researcher finds some other code in the Wayback URLs, which also worked. And so we found out it's alphanumeric. So 26 times 2 plus 10 to the power of 6, which would make like 56 billion combinations. But since I was at another conference, PeachConf, I just changed scraping to slow scraping. So just only one parallel job and add a sleep. And I waited a while, removed some 404s of it. The problem was this slow scraping was not blocked, and we're getting a consistent 1% hit on some random chosen prefixes. So KLM is informed by the NOS, and a few hours later, the NOS network and I get like a nice access denied of the complete KLM and all the brand names that are under Akamai. So what was actually in it? Well, flight info, ticket prices, passenger name records, name, phone number, email addresses, and for international non-Schengen flights also, passport info, visa data. We also see some buttons to remove and update info. We did not click on these buttons. So I got a 1% hit ratio, which would extrapolate to more than 500 million records. The NOS did some random small time scraping and they got like 0.5%. And KLM says, well, this is a very hypothetical calculation. We don't want to comment about the size of the leak, and we take our passenger privacy seriously and have a very sophisticated security policy. Bear to Bear nicely summarized it. Well, if you have a very advanced security policy, apparently implies 0.5% chance of success. So on Monday, it hit the news. It also hit the teletext. 40% of it actually is only KLM, 60% is Air France, lots of TLDs involved on these brand names. We also found out like the PNRs, the passenger name records, are locked plain text to Google Analytics, are 42 tags. Yeah, and also they did some redundancy, SHA-2 of the PNR and street names, etc. So yeah, the moral of the story, always check these short codes, because hundreds of millions of people got these short messages and nobody checked to see if it was really random.
Thank you. Next up is for lazy designers, the page layout LaTeX class.
Yeah, hi, I'm Friedemann, and I want to give you a short introduction to the page layout LaTeX class. I love declarative programming. For me, the idea of telling a computer what it should do and not how it should do works really great. So for websites, HTML itself, it's declarative, and there are a lot of other fancy declarative JavaScript frameworks to use. I also enjoy building apps with Swift UI, and for text documents, I ever since have used Markdown or LaTeX, and when I wanted to create a new photo book, I was thinking about how can I do this also with a declarative approach? How can I create graphic documents declaratively, documents with a page layout, and I didn't find any suitable solution. So I built the page layout LaTeX class and unlocked declarative desktop publishing. So how does it work? First, you set up your page with width and height and margin, gutter and bleed, and you can add some layout guides like a grid, that's a green rectangle, and a safe zone, that's a red rectangle. And then you just create a page with a page command and insert some text with a text command. But you have then the possibility to set some explicit placement of content using the place command. So you define the top left coordinate of your frame and the bottom right coordinate of your frame, and that's that. So you can create layout in this case with two columns. You can use the breakable option for your text, and this way create a two-column text layout. If you want to have a more sophisticated layout, you can use the grid. The grid consists of rows and cells. So in this case, we have a grid of two rows, and each row contains two cells. Then you can add width relations to cells. Also, you can add height relations to rows. And with an exclamation mark, you also can set a relation between the width of a cell and the height of a row. So now every cell has a fixed aspect ratio. You also can override the page dimensions for a page or for a specific grid. And then you can place some content. The content then is automatically distributed across all the cells of the grid. If you want to reuse a layout, you can build templates. In this case, you just need to replace the page command with new template command and give it a name and replace the content with placeholders. Placeholders accept the same arguments as the place command, so you can also set the frame of a placeholder explicit over across multiple cells of the grid. You also can easily create borders and shadows around your content. Shadows are created with Inkscape in the background because LaTeX does not support Gaussian blur. For bitmap graphics, if you have a lot of bitmap graphics in your document, the document can be quite large, quite fast, multiple or several gigabytes in size. And with the optimize command, you can trigger image magic, and then the images are resized and cropped. And you also can set, override the properties for the density of your files, and for JPEG compression, sharpening can be done, and you can configure the downsample threshold. Before printing, you can enable the pre-flight mode with the pre-flight command, and then you see on the top right corner of each image density in pixels per inch. There are even more features, so you can easily create cover pages, double pages, and before pages, or use vector graphics utilizing TIX, a library for vector graphics. And I have some ideas for future features like text and inner shadows, and SVG filter integration would be cool, so you can adjust brightness and saturation and so. Mask border images are ideas. And yeah, if you want to stay up to date, you can follow me on GitHub and Mastodon. Thanks.
Thank you. Next up is smartphones freedom status in 2023. Are you there? Hello? No? All right. We will continue with the next talk, which is Code Heat Open Source Developer Contest, and I will call this talk up again after that. So next up is Code Heat Open Source Developer Contest. There you go. And please adjust the microphones to your...
I'm so short.
Thanks, no problem. You can also put the, that's, we can move the lectern,
Sorry for the trouble. so much better.
Hello, I'm Untari from Indonesia. I'm with First Asia here. First Asia is a community to promote free and open source in Asia. So we have these code hit programs. It's an annual program that for students can join. And where to join? So for you guys that can learn, wants to learn and contribute to free and open source project, and also if you wanna refine your technical skill, and also connect to Asian community force and make friends around the world. And also, there is a fun prize if you manage to get a prize to win First Asia Summit to Hanoi, Vietnam 2024. So how to participate? You can go to codehit.org, and there is eligible project that you can choose. I'm so nervous.
You can see the slides on the screen down there. So,
okay.
Yeah, so you don't have to turn around all the time. No problem.
So there is, you can check in our GitHub. There is a few projects that you can contribute. And one of these is PS Lab, Phuket Science Lab, if you're interested in Python, JavaScript, open hardware, design, and also electronic. Second one, there is OpenEuler, which is if you're interested in C programming, Linux, distribution, or container, virtual machines, and operating system. And you also can check it in our GitHub. And the next project that you can try is EvenYe, which is if you're interested in Python, JavaScript, backend, frontend, and also Android. Second is the LED badges. As you can see, I'm wearing one. So if you're interested in Android developments and Kotlin hardware are also lights, you can check us in the whole tree with bunch of badges there. So you can find us in whole tree later, our code head introductory at the ground floor whole tree for this assembly. Thank you very much, and I hope to see you at the assembly. Sorry.
Thank you. All right, paging smartphones freedom status in 2023 again. Has not appeared. We'll continue with having a good time with Python and Pocket Science Lab.
Again? I think this is fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's great.
Perfect. Okay. So I will be talking a little bit about one of the projects that Tari talked about, the Pocket Science Lab. To begin with, what is it? The Pocket Science Lab is a, I would like to call it a, an open hardware platform, or an open science platform even. It includes a number of sensors and instruments, which you can use during development of, of other projects, troubleshooting, science, education. The sky's the limit. So here are a subset of the instruments and sensors which the Pocket Science Lab, or PS Lab for short, supports and includes. So if you have an analog signal with a high-frequency analog signal from a device or you're troubleshooting a glitchy connector, the Pocket Science Lab has an oscilloscope for that. If you're looking at a less falsely an analog signal which does not change so quickly, multimeter, you got some resistance or a capacitance that you need to figure out how big it is. Also, multimeter for that. If you have a digital signal, even if it's very high frequency, up to multiple megahertz, for example, if you're troubleshooting a serial bus or something like that, the Pocket Science Lab has a logic analyzer. If you need to generate an analog signal yourself to make some noise with a speaker or actuate some kind of sensor with an analog input, the Pocket Science Lab has an analog waveform generator or a function generator. It also has a square function generator or a PWM generator, which you can use to actuate motors, servos, pumps, other kinds of devices. It also has a programmable power source with three voltage outputs and one current output, all of which can be programmed to output voltages and currents to drive different sensors, which you can connect to the Pocket Science Lab. And in addition to those instruments, you can hook up other sensors, such as accelerometer, barometer, compass, etc. So here's just a quick look at two of the instruments, the programmable power source with the three voltage outputs and the oscilloscope. And here's an example of something you can do with it. A robotic arm with four servos, all being controlled by the Pocket Science Lab. So the Pocket Science Lab is fully open. The whole stack, including the hardware and all of the software on top of it, is open source. So we have multiple different pieces of software on top of the hardware written in different languages. So a piece of Python is the main driver layer on PC, written in Python, of course. The desktop app, I see this, it says here it's written in PyQt. That's incorrect. That's outdated. It's now written in JavaScript. Piece of Android, written in Java, possibly moving to Kotlin. And the firmware itself is written in C. So lots of opportunities for different types of developers to work in it. So the next version of the Pocket Science Lab, which we are hard at work developing, has a couple of new features, one of which is it supports Bluetooth and Wi-Fi via an optional ESP module plugin. And it also has an SD card slot. So using those two features, we can use the Pocket Science Lab in the next version, that is, as a passive data collector for field work, where you can either log the data to the SD card or stream it over the network. And the way that works is, normally the Pocket Science Lab is controlled by a host computer over a serial connection. But if we do this in the field, there is no host computer. So what do we replace it with? The way we're doing it right now is we are instead saving a sort of program on the SD card, which contains the exact same bytes as the host computer would send to the PS Lab. And then the PS Lab just does exactly the same thing as it would do if it received those bytes from the host computer. So the drawback of that approach is that there's no branching. Since there are no conditionals. You can't act on the data that you receive, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it is right now. In the future, we would, of course, like to fix that, possibly using allowing users to write their own firmware and flash that to the Pocket Science Lab. Speaking of which, so the Pocket Science Lab uses PIC24 microcontroller. Microchip provides a proprietary tool for flashing firmware with that. We don't like proprietary stuff, so we wrote our own flashing application, MC Boot Flash. If you're using a PIC microchip architecture, you might want to check that out. So that's it. Please join us in our assembly if you're interested in Pocket Science Lab. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So next try, smartphones freedom status in 2020. Oh, it's called Android freedom in 2024, actually. But Dennis, are you around? No? Is somebody here who's on the waiting list? What's your number? Again, please? Martin, I think, all right. I have your talk here, so if Dennis doesn't show up, we'll continue with I make open source software. Or I make open source without programming. Sorry for the surprise. But it's fine, we're still well in time. Surprise lightning talk, so.
Hello. Yeah, let's start. Hello, I'm Doug Blue. I make open source software without programming, mainly because my colleagues say I shouldn't do programming. So let me introduce you. I work for and against the Dutch government. Yes, I'm even smaller. Yes, I'm getting it. You can read my shirt, yes. Let's go to the Dutch government. It consists of a lot of different levels. They all fall under the Freedom of Information Act. And since they're the Dutch government, they spend a shit ton of money on software every year and IT. So they have budgets and there's reality afterwards. As you can see, reality doesn't meet the budget. It's a really lot of software. It comes mainly because of new is always better. A lot of organizations have specific needs and a not invented here syndrome. And every new project is way cooler than the old one because they do it always better. So let's dig in. There's a Freedom of Information Act in the Netherlands, as in a lot of European countries. All documents from the government should be public. Everybody can request them. You shouldn't be a citizen. There are no really rules about it. They should give it within 4 weeks to you. And yes, so since you can print source code, it's a document, was my theory. So let's try it. So I sent a very nice Freedom of Information request in Dutch. I said, I want the app, I want the backend, I want the cryptographics, I want everything, CI/CD. And because this ministry also makes the Freedom of Information policies, that's the right place to try. It worked. That came a lot of questions in a very nice lunch meeting with them. Do we have the source code? No, they didn't. Their supplier had. Do we legally own the source code? And that answer was yes. That was the important one. They assessed that the application, which is on most of Dutch citizens' mobile phone, was very risky to be open sourced. It's Xamarin, and you can decompile it from .NET to readable code in C#. It's very easy. And the backend should be fine. That question was also, no, that's more difficult. But it worked. They open sourced the apps. The backends will come. It will take some more time. We're now busy 1.5 years. But the deadline is now, I think, the 29th of February or 1st of April, some nice date. So the app got open sourced. People found problems. So this is debugging code. This is the bigger problem they found. Congratulations to the internet. The next steps, I went to the tax authority and asked for 40-year-old code. It's now somewhat older because I'm also older. It's made in CoolGen. It's a COBOL generator. They denied it being a risk for the security and the financial situation of the Dutch state, which is, okay, I pay taxes, how does this work? Then the question is there any profits in it? Yes, they sent letters to inform the Dutch parliament that they open sourced code based on the Freedom of Information request. So that's what I'm going to use at more organizations in the Netherlands and already did. Any questions afterwards, just find me somewhere. I'm wearing a big yellow hoodie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we start with the German part of the session, I would say there's one final call for Android security in 2024. Dennis? No reaction. So then we take a talk from the waiting list, if you like. So you can just go ahead and get up on stage. It was Honey, I Federated the Search Engine, right? Okay, I have the right one. That would have been awkward.
Hello, I'm Martin. This is a very quick set of slides that I threw together because of something, a conversation that I had with a couple of people over the last couple of days. And it's really all about how the web has become very difficult to search. So it's super hard now to find anything. You go on a search engine, they're full of ads, they're full of self-dealing, so it's promotion for the search engine operators, products and services. They're full of SEO spam, and of course now they're also full of garbage hallucinations generated by large language models. So we go to search, do we find what we're looking for? Maybe not. If we're lucky, we do. I'm going to say here, I think this problem is just getting worse. This is just the beginning. Now that so many people are there saying, okay, what can I do with an LLM? What can I get this to generate for me? And you'll see agencies advertising their services to generate huge numbers of web pages for you with LLMs. Oh, and hey, some of the ads are actually maladvertisements which deliver malware and compromise your machine. So if you're unlucky enough to click on it, then you might end up with more than you bargained for. So what could we do about this? And back in the day, before Google, actually before AltaVista, before Lycos, there were a lot of people trying to figure out how we connect little independent islands of content, of information together. And I talked about a few of them on this slide here. I'm not going to talk about them in detail because I'll run out of time. But there's one that I think is particularly interesting, which is called Harvest, which is a federated, distributed approach to searching and finding stuff. Okay, the net was a bit smaller back in the 1990s. We've grown a bit since then. What could we do with what we know now, and particularly the information and the tools that we have now? And I'm going to suggest that things like RSS, things like XML sitemap feeds, these are really useful for building a little personal, a customized search. But we also have meta search engines like SearchNG. If anyone's played with that, that sits in front of regular search engines and kind of trustworthy sites. Places like, and I'm going to say it here, Wikipedia. I think a lot of bad press for Wikipedia in the media, but this is a really trustworthy site because of all of the editorial process. So what can we do? Can we kind of stick all these bits together somehow? This diagram's probably too small for you to read, but the boxes in blue are SearchNG and some modules, and it has dozens and dozens of modules for talking to search engines that you know and love, but also to kind of authoritative sources like Crossref for scientific research papers. And the boxes in a kind of yellowy orange, those are the bits that we kind of need to figure out. What if you could plug some personalized search into this? What if we could use things like RSS from Fediverse updates, but without compromising people's privacy and who they want to share that information with? So that's me. I just started thinking about this, but now I've put it in your heads. So I'm really interested in what you think about it. You've got my details up there, or come and find me. I'd love to talk to you about this. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Then next up is Holy Mutt. Are you here? All right, we'll continue with the next talk. Yeah, we are going to get used to this. Treffen sich zwei Akronyme. Nee. Treffen sich 27 Akronyme.
Genau, es sind ein bisschen mehr.
Ja.
Alles klar. Ja, hallo, mein Name ist Sandra und ich habe ein Problem. Ich rede oft enthusiastisch über Akronyme und niemand aus meinem Hackspace versteht mich. Jetzt würde ich gerne mal hier im Raum fragen, wer von euch hat denn schon mal was von dem Akronym NFTI gehört und wüsste jetzt, was das bedeutet? Okay, da gehen sehr wenige Hände hoch. Sehr, sehr schade, aber genau das ist das Problem, weil ich glaube, dass die NFTI was ist, was in dieser Community durchaus sehr viel bekannter sein sollte. Genau. Und es hat sich beispielsweise ergeben, dass ein Freund von mir auch mal gesagt hat, du Sandra, ich verstehe dich einfach nicht. Und jetzt weiß ich ganz genau, wie sich jemand fühlt, der zu uns in den Hackspace kommt, ohne IT-Hintergrund und erstmal nur Bahnhof versteht. So, und ich versuche jetzt mal, den Bahnhof ein bisschen aufzulösen. Also, worum geht's? NFDI steht für Nationale Forschungsdateninfrastruktur. Das ist ein Projekt, das ist ein bisschen abenteuerlich, muss man ehrlich zugeben, gefördert durch die Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft. Und es geht im Kern erstmal um Forschungsdatenmanagement. Das ist erstmal ein ziemlich langweiliges Konzept, es wirkt relativ schwer, aber die Inhalte, die Zutaten sozusagen, sind eigentlich ziemlich cool. Es geht insgesamt um Open Source, es geht um Open Data und Open Science, es geht aber auch unter anderem um Community und Culture Change in der Wissenschaft. Ganz genau gesagt geht es darum, dass Forschungsdaten fair gemacht werden sollen. Und vielleicht haben einige mehr von euch schon was von den FAIR-Prinzipien gehört. Es geht im Prinzip darum, Forschungsdaten findable, accessible, interoperable und reusable zu machen, also sie auffindbar zu machen, zugänglich, interoperabel und nachnutzbar. Da geht es unter anderem um Metadaten, da geht es um Lizenzen, da geht es aber beispielsweise auch einfach darum, dass Standards eingehalten werden. Genau. Insgesamt soll das mehr Offenheit und Transparenz in die Wissenschaft bringen und beispielsweise wissenschaftliche Silos aufbrechen. Doch wo bleiben jetzt eigentlich diese ganzen anderen Akronyme, die ich halt angekündigt habe? Und man fragt sich vielleicht auch, welche Daten denn eigentlich? Und es gibt ja nicht die eine Wissenschaft, sondern es gibt viele verschiedene wissenschaftliche Disziplinen. Und in der NFDI gibt es 26 Fachkonsortien, die disziplinspezifisch versuchen, Probleme, die es beim Datenteilen in den jeweiligen Wissenschaften gibt, zu lösen durch Services, durch die Entwicklung von Infrastruktur. Und da gibt es halt so ein paar, die haben sich sehr abenteuerlich wirkende Akronyme ausgesucht, beispielsweise DAPHNE steht für Daten aus Photonen- und Neutronenexperimenten oder BIRD für Business and Ecological and Related Data. Mein Lieblingsakronym ist PUNCH, was das bedeutet, das könnt ihr selber rausfinden. Das sind mal alle Konsortien. Man sieht, bei einigen kann man genauer erkennen, wo sie sich zuordnen, mit welchen Daten sie sich beschäftigen. Ich glaube, wir haben leider nicht genug Zeit, um alle Akronyme durchzugehen. Das könnt ihr euch dann einfach in Ruhe nochmal anschauen. Und wie sich die ein oder anderen vielleicht auch denken können, gibt es natürlich auch bei diesen 26 Projekten, die sozusagen für ihre eigene Disziplin arbeiten, auch so Themen, die sie im Querschnitt verbinden. Deshalb gibt es in der NFDI auch so Querschnittsarbeitsgruppen, die sogenannten Sektionen, die sich beispielsweise mit den Themen Common Infrastructure, Metadaten, Training and Education, Ethical, Legal and Social Aspects oder auch dem Aspekt Industry Engagement beschäftigen. Insgesamt geht es aber auch ganz stark um den Aspekt Cultural Change. Das hatte ich ja schon erwähnt, denn keine Technologie, die ich entwickle, nützt mir was, wenn die Forschenden sie nicht anwenden. Das ist sozusagen auch einer der Kernaspekte, den sich die NFDI als Ziel gesetzt hat. Das war es im Prinzip schon. Das war leider nur ein ganz, ganz kurzer Teaser dafür. Es ging jetzt wirklich nur darum, euch mal so ein bisschen zu erklären, was sich hinter diesem Akronym NFDI verbergen könnte. Wenn ihr da mehr Interesse zu habt, wenn ihr vielleicht auch Fragen habt oder Diskussionsbedarf, dann könnt ihr uns gern ansprechen. Wir sind heute zu erkennen an unseren super coolen NFDI-Hoodies, werden aber auch die Tage noch da sein. Oder ihr kommt einfach später heute zum Science Communication Center, wo wir ein kleines Meetup organisieren und könnt da einfach eure Fragen alle loswerden. Das war's von mir. Vielen Dank für die Aufmerksamkeit und ich hoffe, ich habe die Verwirrung etwas aufgelöst. Danke.
Danke. So, Holy Mud ist eingetroffen, habe ich gesehen. Ja, da vorne. Wann soll ich das Video starten? Jetzt?
Jetzt, ja, gerne.
Okay, gut.
Gerne, ja. Merci.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak here with my broken, bad German English. I'm sent from the artist collective 141, which is called KK141. And actually, we have here this is the Church of Mud, because we love mud. Mud often is like people say mud, oh, it's dirty, like You know, here, this is real mud from near Lützerath, where I live now, like 7 kilometers away from Lützerath mud. And maybe you all know the guy Matschmönch, Mud Wizard. And what our project is, we want to build a memorial for Mud Wizard. Like, you know, everybody knows Mud Wizard from these YouTube platforms. And the guy called Martin Lejeune, in former time, yeah, she knows in the front row, I know her too. She knows the story. Like, I was candidate for German Bundestag in 2017, and I shaved myself then these days. And actually, there was a journalist who didn't like my election campaign posters because I made penises. I was making very big penises from like teig, dough, cookie, for, yeah, from dough, and baking them and installing them into my election campaign posters in Berlin, Prenzlauer Berg and Pankow and so on. And Martin Lejeune really was pissed about it, and he said, hey, what a pervert, our kids gonna, like, we have to do something about this pervert. That's the story with Martin Lejeune. But Martin Lejeune, luckily, was also there when Lützerath was evicted. And there was a big, big demonstration with 35,000 people against around 10,000 policemen. And yeah, and Mud Monk did it. He brought like protesters and demonstrants and the police together, closer together, like, and yeah, look at him, like, oh yeah, here's, you can see here Mud Monk. Yeah. Actually, it's just for illustration purposes, some YouTube video I like speed it up like 3 times faster or something. And actually, if you, if the 5 minutes are over, then you can watch this talk like 10 times and read the whole shit that's standing up there. Because it's a serious thing. It's not only a fun project, it's an art project. And we want to build a statue of Matschmönch, yeah, of this guy, and also the police guy, in one-to-one, like Maßstab 1:1 in German, like the same size as he was, shall be a statue of Mud Monk, like, yeah, hitting. I will try to simulate with him. So actually, it's all about this scene, like, and you read what is standing there, and I shut up. And yeah, we would be really, really thankful if you support us. At the moment, we know everything how to do it, and the only thing is like missing money or industrial help. Like, if somebody has a big 3D gluing facility, please contact us. That would be really great. Or like, we do it with German Portalfräse at the moment, but yeah. Now you know what it's all about, and here, read this. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for having me here.
Thank you. Careful, there's the state. Yeah, great. All right. Okay. Then next up is Hakmas Castle. Hawk. That's something between A and O I can't pronounce. Ah, Hawk. Please, one of you should stand in front of the microphone because they don't have that much of range. You can see the slides down there. Turn to the right.
Okay. Right. Okay, hi. We're some of the life forms behind Hackmas Castle. So, and we invite you to hack a castle with us. This one.
So you might have heard that in Austria we have a lot of nice castles, but this one already comes with a lot of hacker infrastructure. So we have patch panels in all rooms, we have a nice camping meadow, we have fiber internet, we have DMX lights, and we have workshop and seminar rooms, and we are allowed to use all of this. So let's make use of it. Yeah, also we have soundproof party towers and there will be junk. And basically it's going to be a hacker event. We want to make a hacker event in a castle. It's not just a camp, we have sleep rooms, but it's also a camping area, and it's gonna be barcamp style talks and hopefully you guys having a good time. We're planning on selling about 450 tickets, and for maximum comfort, there are even some hotel rooms maybe for up to 50 people. And if you don't want to sleep outside, there will be sleeping dormitories, and if you want to come with your tent, you can, because there's a camping meadow between the apple trees, but you will have to take care of the apple trees, of course. It's a vitamin alert, yeah? So they're tasty.
So, that sounds like an awesome event. Now you might ask yourself, when is this happening? It's happening next year. For just a reminder, it's 2024. In the last week of August, from build-up is August 28th, and teardown is September 1st. Where is it happening? As you probably guessed, it's in Austria. Specifically in Lower Austria, Ottenschlag, so it's not that far away from Germany. Don't worry, be campy. Specifically, it's in between Linz and Vienna in Ottenschlag, and it's easily available by car or train, and we are organizing a shuttle bus. So, the only thing that's missing is you, and we invite you to our event, Hackmas Castle. On our website, we also have a link to our Mastodon account and to our to our Matrix room. So please come and have fun with us.
Thank you.
And please get in touch outside of the hall with us.
All right, thanks. Then next up is Digital Druide. I'm sorry for the mix-up with the German and English talks. Sometimes the speakers change it last minute. Sometimes I just don't get it.
Yeah, it was an Austrian talk anyway.
Okay.
So, and our German is not the yellow from the egg.
Hello. Yeah, it's a German talk, so ich spreche Deutsch. Wir wollen Digitaldruide vorstellen. Das ist ein kleines Spaßprojekt von uns, da haben wir sehr viel Zeit reingesteckt, genauso wie den QR-Code, gerne mal scannen. Was tun wir? Wir haben einen Esoteritech spezialisierten Webshop gebaut. Da kann man ganz tolle Produkte kaufen, zum Beispiel das Soulwatch IT Monitoring oder den WLAN-Traumfänger. Und ja, das wollten wir jetzt mal kurz pitchen, mal die Produkte vorstellen und ich gebe mal weiter.
So, also wir haben eine sehr breite Produktpalette von Appliances über Workshops bis hin zum Tech-Stack für den Admin. Ist wirklich alles dabei. Darunter findet man zum Beispiel hier unsere brandneue Innovation, die Kira-Disk. Die basiert auf hochmoderner linksdrehenden Technologien, weil wie jeder weiß, die rechtsdrehende Malware kann man natürlich nicht auf linksdrehender Festplatten speichern. Wir bieten einen Ransomware-Yoga-Workshop an, dafür, dass man halt, wenn man geransomwared wird, hier wunderschön die Ruhe bewahren kann und da so ein bisschen entspannter rangeht. Auch sehr beliebt unser Mate-Satz-Lesen-Workshop, dadurch, dass man halt genau wissen kann, wann man jetzt gecybert wird. Wir haben auch unseren digitalen Rettungssanitäter. Das ist eine Ausbildung, die empfehle ich wirklich jedem, der in der IT unterwegs ist. Ja, ansonsten sehr beliebt die Verschlüsselersalze, stark angelehnt an die Schüsslersalze sind die auch hier für unsere Server, Rechner und Infrastruktur allgemein in verschiedenen Potenzen natürlich erhältlich. Ja, was ist hier auf der Folie nicht drauf steht, wir haben auch den Ethernet-Vorheizer. Der ist gerade hier am Kongress, wenn hier die Torrents mal nicht so gut laufen, ziemlich praktisch, weil dann wird das Ethernet-Kabel vorgeheizt und die Bandbreite ist einfach schon ready und da. Was wir natürlich auch noch haben, ist das WD42. Falls mir irgendwas nicht ganz so gut funktioniert in der IT, einfach WD42 drauf und es läuft wieder wie geschmiert.
Gut. Ja, das ist wieder deine Slide. Ja, wir haben auch gesagt, wir gehen mit der Zeit. Bei uns ist nicht hier Kreditkarte oder Bitcoin, sondern wir haben gesagt, wir machen Pay with Pray. Das ist eine hochmoderne Kryptowährung zur Zahlungsabwicklung. Wir haben gesagt, wir machen den Proof of Belief. Da bekommt nicht, wer schon hat. Und es ist auch umweltschonender als Proof of Work. Wir machen kollektive Gebetssitzungen zur Zahlungsverifikation. Das hat gleich noch den Vorteil, dass das spirituell gleich noch mal ein bisschen gesegnet. Ne? Derzeit sind wir leider noch in der Bootstrapping-Phase. Wir wurden schon gefragt, ich kann nichts kaufen. Ja, wir haben noch nicht so viel gebetet, aber wir sind dabei. Wenn ihr euch anschließen wollt, gerne zu uns kommen. Ansonsten, falls wir euch gehuckt haben, wir haben sehr viele Produkte, wir arbeiten da auch kontinuierlich dran weiter. Wenn wir da nicht dran arbeiten, dann malen wir tolle QR-Codes. Ansonsten quatscht uns einfach an, wir sind hier, wir haben hier tolle T-Shirts und du hast deinen Zipper nicht an. Ja. Ihr erkennt uns, ansonsten haben wir auch noch Segnungsbildchen dabei, die könnt ihr auch haben, könnt ihr auf eure Laptops draufkleben, dann sind die total sicher und dann ist alles gut. Vielen Dank, viel Spaß im Kongress.
Danke. Als nächstes Schulplaner für das digitale Zeitalter.
Hi, ich möchte euch heute die Open Source Web App Tulul vorstellen, die ich etwa seit Juli entwickelt habe. Tulul ist ein kollaborativer Schulplaner, darauf ausgelegt, von Schülern als Klassengemeinschaft gemeinsam genutzt zu werden. Man kann normale Hausaufgaben hochladen, es gibt einen Kalender für Vokabeltests oder Klausuren und es gibt private als auch öffentliche Notizen, wobei private Notizen nicht richtig privat sind, da sie nicht verschlüsselt werden, sondern man halt nur selber auf sie Zugriff. Da stellt sich natürlich die Frage, was spricht gegen ein normales Hausaufgabenheft und für eine digitale Lösung? Viele Schüler arbeiten bereits digital, zum Beispiel mit einem Tablet, aber nutzen dann dennoch ein analoges Hausaufgabenheft. Das ist einfach unnötig kompliziert, dass man zwei nicht miteinander kompatible Systeme hat. Zumal das normale Hausaufgabenheft dann nur ein Jahr lang nutzbar ist. Der Verlust eines Hausaufgabenhefts führt auch direkt zum kompletten Datenverlust, da die Daten nur an einem zentralen Ort gespeichert werden. Wenn man nur einmalig fehlt oder krank ist oder so, dann kann man sich die Daten noch von anderen erfragen. Es ist aber bereits ein unnötiger Mehraufwand. Zu guter Letzt gibt es kein organisiertes System, weswegen die Daten sehr unorganisiert werden können und es sehr viel Aufwand sein kann, dass die Daten organisiert bleiben. Da stellt sich natürlich auch die zweite Frage, warum ausgerechnet Tulul und nicht irgendeine andere App, die es so gibt? Tulul bietet alles Nötige. Es gibt Hausaufgaben, Notizen und einen Kalender, wie ich bereits erläutert habe. Dann ist Tulul aber auch noch Open Source. Es gibt keine Tracker, also man wird gar nicht getrackt. Und es gibt eine freie, dokumentierte API, die die Daten in sehr vielen Formaten wie JSON, XML oder auch TodoTXT zurückgeben kann. Das ermöglicht einen Umstieg weg auch sehr einfach und ist eben auch ein Fokus auf Open Data. Tulul ist höchstgradig kollaborativ, dazu erläutere ich gleich noch mehr. Und es gibt ganz viele kleine Details und Einstellungen, die es angenehmer zu nutzen machen. Jetzt habe ich schon ein paar Mal gesagt, dass das alles kollaborativ ist. Aber was bedeutet das eigentlich zum echten Nutzen? Normalerweise sagt der Lehrer irgendetwas an und 20 bis 30 Schüler schreiben sich genau dasselbe auf. Ist schon unnötig kompliziert, dass 20 bis 30 Leute dasselbe machen, aber es geht irgendwie noch. Schlussendlich wird es aber halt trotzdem geteilt, zum Beispiel wenn jemand eben fehlt, wird es häufig in die Klassengruppe geschickt oder ähnliches. Und dieses Teilen, das wird eben automatisiert. Es reicht, wenn ein einziger Schüler die Daten einträgt und direkt können alle die Daten lesen. Das ist auch sehr angenehm, wenn man eben dann mal fehlt, weil man muss nur einmal die Website öffnen und man kann direkt sehen, was so alles los ist. Ist ja alles schön und gut, aber wie kann man das jetzt alles nutzen? Man kann sich einen Account erstellen, dafür braucht man einen einzigartigen Nutzernamen, einen öffentlich sichtbaren Anzeigenamen und kann die Schule und Klasse angeben. Wenn die Schule und Klasse nicht vorgeschlagen wird, kann man einfach selber den Namen reinschreiben und es wird im System erstellt. Dann noch ein sicheres Passwort und man hat einen Account. Dann kann man sich mit dem einzigartigen Nutzernamen und dem sicheren Passwort einloggen, um dann Daten hinzufügen zu können. Die ganzen Unterlinks zu den einzelnen Subseiten, die kann man entweder oben oder unten im Footer bzw. der Navigation finden oder wenn man Steuerung bzw. Command-K drückt. Dann gibt es eine Suche, wo man absolut alles finden kann. Dann kann man ganz simpel die Daten einfach eintragen. Und ich bin schneller als erwartet. Beim Üben zu Hause habe ich länger gebraucht. Also danke fürs Zuhören. Hier könnt ihr noch einen QR-Code finden. Dank Tulul könnt ihr jetzt, wenn ihr noch Schüler seid, immer wissen, was die Hausaufgaben überhaupt sind. Es ist ein System, das es leicht macht, aber man muss es immer noch selber machen. Ich bin viel schneller als erwartet. Ja.
Dankeschön. Apparently I have some open slides there. Now back to the file manager and the last few talks. Where do we have it? Analog pixel print workshop.
Hi, my name is Alan, and I will talk about pixel printing with Lego. After this talk, you have the, it comes the real fun, you have the opportunity to try out the process. First, we will stick off a motif. Then we will color the stones. Cleaning the surroundings. Add a second color. Place the printing material. Place the printing felt. And pull the printing roller over it. Then we have the print result. In addition to figures and abstract motifs, text is also possible. We have here an example. More examples like Christmas trees are from my last workshops. And this cat also. The location is in hall one in the Zwischenfoyer. I've prepared a sketch sheet for the workshop, and you can download it from the URL I show. My model is the Holznudel is My model for the Holznudel is the provisional press from the States. Instead of a plastic printing roller, I used a rolling pin called in German Nudelholz. The German printing height was very important to me in the design. This means you can use old cliches, wooden and lead type. The construction plans and data will be published at holznudel.de. I would like to introduce another model of an open source press, the open source the Open Press project. It's a 3D printed press in this format, and small 8x8 pin boards from Lego that fit into it. You can access the printing data in, on Cineverse. Last but not least, a book tip. Roy and Martin have experimented a lot with Lego letterpress and achieved very nice results. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, we still have almost a quarter of an hour left and only one talk. Is anybody here from the waiting list? Jemand von der Warteliste? No. Come up. Who are you? We still have some time. Now I have to access the talk system and download your slide because I didn't prepare for this. We'll see. Now, can you please tell me the name of the talk again? Letzipedia. Right. All right, I'll just quickly download this. We used to have a Jeopardy melody for this.
In the meantime, a big sorry from us to the translation angels. You are doing a marvelous work out there, and we make just currently making life a bit difficult for you, so a big sorry about this. But please give a big round of applause to all those people in the back who support us, the translation angels, and so on. Thank you very much.
All right, I got it. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tomato. I am a 3D artist and I lived in Lützerath for 2.5 years. And I made 3D scans of the village over this time. And I'm planning to build a tool where you can browse and explore Lützerath in 3D and over time. And I'm not so good in presentation, so I just brought a video that we can watch together, so film up.
Oh, that's right, I also have to download a video.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem, I mean, that's what I forgot. I hope I downloaded it somewhere. Otherwise, I have to check my email live on stage.
Yeah, there's a YouTube link also, if this is...
Is the YouTube link in the description of the talk somewhere? I think I have it. Yeah, here it is. Let's see. I'm not good with computers.
Let's stop time for a minute.
Me too.
You're just improvising.
So the Lucky Cloud page says requested page could not be found, but I'll take the YouTube video instead.
Okay.
And just have to switch the tab over to the other side. All right, here we go.
Also, we have sound if it's possible.
Oh, I don't know if we have sound.
Okay, then it's so fine.
Not instantly, no, sorry. But maybe you can say something too.
It's playing music right now.
Okay.
I know some thunder is...
I have a loose cable here, maybe.
Some click sounds. Now the music starts. Perfect timing. Thank you. If you want to join the project, there's the skills needed, like programming and stuff. You can find my contact information up there. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, then we still have somebody from the waiting list, because we still have time. No. All right, then we'll have our last talk for today. It's going to be KI-Überwachung auf dem Hansaplatz.
Ja, wir sind hier in Hamburg und nicht so weit weg von hier auf dem Hansaplatz in der Nähe vom Hauptbahnhof sieht es aus wie auf anderen Plätzen in der Nähe von Bahnhöfen in großen Städten. Es gibt dort Menschen, die von anderen Menschen nicht so gern gesehen werden. Zum Beispiel gibt es dort eine Trinkerszene, es gibt eine Drogenszene, es gibt Prostitution und dagegen möchte man etwas tun. 2019 bereits hat man dort Kameras installiert, 16 Stück an der Zahl. Das sind sehr, sehr schöne Kameras, die aus China kommen, die können sogar Minderheiten erkennen, die können Gesichtserkennung. Diese Features nutzt man in Hamburg nicht. Hier möchte man datenschutzfreundlich sein und aus diesem Grund setzt man hier auf KI. Heute ist es nämlich so, dass Polizistinnen und Polizisten nicht ganz rund um die Uhr, aber offenbar viel zu lange vor Bildschirmen sitzen und beurteilen, was dort passiert. Das heißt, anstatt dass die Polizei dort auf dem Platz herumläuft, gibt es ein Kommissariat in der Nähe, wo die Polizistinnen und Polizisten dann prüfen, ob etwas passiert. Und wenn etwas passiert, können sie den Kollegen, die sich vielleicht doch in der Nähe aufhalten, Bescheid sagen. Genau, und KI soll das besser können. Hier setzt man auf eine Strichfiguren-KI von Fraunhofer. Ich habe das mal exemplarisch nachgemalt. In der Realität sieht es ganz ähnlich aus. Und diese Strichfiguren-KI soll dann bewerten, ob die Menschen, die auf diesem Platz beobachtet werden, sich gerade angepasst und unauffällig verhalten. Und sobald das nicht der Fall ist, geht ein Lämpchen an und dann kann die Polizei wieder ihren Wagen losschicken. Was heißt angepasst und unauffällig? Unerwünscht ist zum Beispiel das Liegen. Mengen von Schaulustigen sind nicht willkommen. Es soll eine offensive und eine defensive Haltung von Strichfiguren erkannt werden. Genau. Wo da die Strafbarkeit gegeben ist, weiß ich nicht. Das konnte auch die Polizei nicht erklären. Aber ich glaube, das Ganze ist trotzdem überhaupt nicht problematisch. Denn ich zitiere kurz aus dem Koalitionsvertrag des Rot-Grünen Senats. Hier beim Einsatz von KI soll es Transparenz, Nachvollziehbarkeit, Überprüfbarkeit, Diskriminierungsfreiheit geben. Das heißt, wir können diese KI ohne schlechtes Gewissen einsetzen und haben eine schöne neue Welt. Kommen wir zu einem kurzen Realitätsabgleich. Transparenz gibt es nicht. Ich habe wahrscheinlich vor dem hamburgischen Datenschutzbeauftragten von diesem Projekt erfahren. Der hat nämlich aus der Zeitung davon gehört. Nachvollziehbarkeit und Überprüfbarkeit gibt es auch nicht. Das Projekt wurde als quasi Blackbox von Fraunhofer eingekauft und alle möglichen Detailfragen konnte die Polizei bei diesem System nicht beantworten. Das System ist wahrscheinlich auch nicht diskriminierungsfrei. Es gab eine Frage, wie verhält sich das System bei Rollstuhlfahrenden? Und da konnte die Polizei nichts zu sagen. Es gibt aber Berichte darüber, dass dieses System Probleme mit Personen hat, die Kinderwagen schieben. So richtig Ahnung von dem System scheinen sie auch nicht zu haben, weil in den Pressemitteilungen dazu immer mal wieder was anderes steht. Werden jetzt Menschenmengen als potenziell strafbar eingestuft oder nicht? Ist Liegen gefährlich oder nicht? Außerdem glaubt man, dass man durch intelligente Kameraüberwachung lebensbedrohliche Straftaten frühzeitig verhindern kann. Und dann, selbst wenn man dieses System nutzen würde, mögen würde, haben wollen möchte, wäre das ein ziemlich schlechter Kauf. Denn dieses System basiert auf einem System, was in Mannheim schon 5 Jahre in einem sogenannten Pilotprojekt eingesetzt wird. Und dieses Pilotprojekt wurde gerade um 2 Jahre verlängert, weil das System nicht funktioniert. Ja, weil andere und ich das Ganze nicht so schön finden, lade ich jetzt ein zu einem Überwachungsspaziergang oder vielmehr lädt der CCC Hansestadt Hamburg e.V. ein, denn das Ganze ist eine angemeldete Demo und ab 40 Leuten dürfen wir uns auch auf der Fahrbahn bewegen. Wir treffen uns entweder gleich am Hacker-Tours-Desk oder vor Ort ganz in der Nähe des Hauptbahnhofs, wo hier der Kreis ist, auf dem Heidi-Kabel-Platz und dann können wir gemeinsam diese schönen Kameras aus der Nähe betrachten. Das Pilotprojekt ist offiziell vorüber. Ich weiß nicht, ob man es tatsächlich abgeschaltet hat, aber die Kameras, die 2019 installiert wurden, ja, laufen weiter. Und wenn ihr da gleich mit hinkommt, folgt mir einfach. Ich habe ein unauffälliges Megafon gleich in der Hand. Ja, ich würde mich freuen, wenn ihr euch das auch einmal aus der Nähe anschauen wollt. Da das eine Demo ist, habe ich die Polizei gebeten, die Kameras sichtbar außer Betrieb zu nehmen. Wir können dann gespannt sein, ob das passiert ist.
Dankeschön. All right, so that concludes today's Lightning Talk sessions. Thank you all for being here. And thanks to all the speakers who delivered their talk today. Great work.
Thank you all. Have a nice conference.